It's that time again.
We go beyond the jive.
Join our hosts, John Swan and Natalie B.
Brave the sting of beekeeping to reap the sweet rewards.
All you Hive Jive junkies out there, this is the Hive Jive. Jive.
And go!
Do this! Yay!
Oh, well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another Beekeeper Chat.
Hi, everyone. We're happy to be with you again.
We are. We are. Real quick, before we get too far along, this means verbally, I guess I can say this, and then it'll mean something for those listening. And then people that are watching, you can see it and you'll see. But we talked in the last episode about the comb guides.
Yeah, I got mine too.
Oh, you did? Did they show up today or yesterday?
Hey, today.
Today?
Oh, mine showed up. They might have been in the mailbox yesterday, but I didn't.
Well, that's kind of cool because you ordered yours before mine and then I ordered mine and they came in today. So for those of you who have the video, you can see here, this is the comb guide. There is a letter in the center of it and I honestly haven't even pulled it out and looked at it yet. But the funny thing is I had already forgotten about it. So we ordered it right before, like I ordered mine right before we did the episode last week. And then it came in and it comes in this tube, almost like a poster tube, right? And when you shake it, it has this bag of all of the hardware and I could hear that jingling around and I was like, what the hell is this? And I'm like, I don't remember ordering anything that would have come in a tube. What is this?
Yeah, no, I knew because the label said Manicet on it. So I knew that's what it was.
I was just like, mom brought him downstairs and handed him to me while I was down here working on stuff. And she was like, here, this came in the mail for you. And I was like, what is that? And she was like, I don't know. And I just started playing with it. Like, I didn't even read it. I was just like shaking it and like opening it. So I was like, what is this?
It's like a mystery gift.
Well, my first thought was it better not be a pipe bomb.
So shake it, right?
Shake it. Well, because I could hear these things jingling and I was like, shrapnel.
Yeah. Proceed with caution.
Proceed with caution. Exactly. But so mine came in. They have a very distinct burnt smell because, very burnt smell burnt. They were laser etched, you know, so a laser did actually cut through the wood and everything on that. I just wanted to bring that up because it was kind of cool. It came in and it was like, it was a surprise. I had already forgotten. It was like early Christmas.
Yeah. And like to your point, it does smell burnt. Because I do engraving of our hive pieces. And it reminds me of that same burned pine smell.
It's got a very interesting smell. And this is supposedly aspen. It's not aspen. What was it? It was something that almost made me think of balsa wood, but it's not balsa wood. it is a very distinct aroma to it. So anyhow, so we won't carry on about that for any longer. I just wanted to say that we did get them. I think it's awesome that we both got them basically at the same time. We will be assembling them, installing them in top bars. And we will do another episode down the road to talk about how that went. So don't expect that anytime soon, though, because we got to get them in there. We got to let the bees actually draw them out. My bees don't show up until April, so it will not be before April.
That's right. Yeah. And then you got to give them the time to build the comb and kind of see what the effect is longer term, if we like them or not. So this is going to be we might talk about it in passing, but it's going to be a while before we can really give an educated feedback on these.
That is true. All right. So outside of the fun little toys and gadgets that we have received that we did our impromptu review of last week, this week we are going to talk about queen excluders and the pros, the cons, the different uses, when you should, when you shouldn't, if there is such a thing as should and shouldn't. And we'll kind of go through that. And this is actually prompted. I will say this is prompted because I did a day-long seminar last Saturday. And there was an individual who is very insistent or persistent on wanting to talk about queen excluders. This has kind of sparked me to be like, you know what? We'll just use that as a topic for this week and go through and talk about it because it's kind of fresh on the mind. As a teaser, though, for next week, we are going to talk about the aspects of bees learning and how they can learn, but not necessarily just that aspect of it, but the ramifications of what does it mean if some of these research things that are coming out now, where we're finding out more about how they learn and how they teach each other and things, how could that potentially inform future beekeeping and the way that we actually handle and approach the bees and things like that? So we will be talking about that next week. So there you go. You've got your follow-up on the last episode. You got a teaser for the next episode. So I suppose we should probably talk about this episode.
Let's kind of do it. Let's kind of commit to the actual topic.
The actual topic. Well, that is so not fun. I'm kidding. Okay. So queen excluders, everybody should know what those are. And technically, yes, they are in a Langstroth colony, but they could be retrofitted for a lay-ins. They can be retrofitted for a horizontal hive, both as a divider going horizontally or as the entrance. And I do that all the time. If you guys remember back early on in the show, or if you've ever seen any of the postings of the stuff that I've done on social media, you will see these brightly colored big discs that are on the front of my top bar hives. Those are, I call them entrance discs. They're called hive portals on the place that you actually buy them. And they do have kind of a adjustable queen excluder. You can have fully open, you can have fully vented, or you can do queen exclude or drone exclude. And the whole concept of a queen excluder is to create bars of whatever material that are close enough together so that a worker bee can get out, because she's got smaller thorax, smaller abdomen, so she can get out of there. But a queen bee could not, who has a larger thorax and a much larger abdomen.
Right.
Commercial beekeepers, that's the main place you're going to actually hear about queen excluders. And that's, again, if you think about where a lot of these books and educational things come from, a lot of them are written from the perspective of a commercial beekeeper, and then they're just dumbed down to a backyard level, which is really not fair because it makes everybody think, oh, but that's how it has to be. But if you're really just a backyard beekeeper with one or two colonies, you don't have to follow those rules because you're not on a commercial time scale. You're not working towards their calendar and you don't have the same goals and objectives. So today's questions are, when should I use a queen excluder? Is it required? And what are the different things that can be done with the queen excluder? So that's where we're going to use as our jumping off point for today.
So yeah, exactly. And by the way, you hang out with me way too much, because that's kind of what I tell everybody. You know, 95% of the beekeepers out there are basically backyard, small scale, static beekeepers that are not transporting their hives. So they have other constraints and basically a little luxury to do things completely different from what the commercials beekeepers do. They have to transport their bees. They have to feed them earlier. They have to keep, you know, the queens confined to certain areas, things that we don't have necessarily to do as backyard beekeepers. But to this point, the segue is the queen excluder is meant, and that's the name indicates it, to exclude the queens from certain areas, whether it's inside the hives or to keep exclude them from having access to supers, to another box, to the outside even. So very often commercial beekeepers use those to keep the queens confined to the brood box so that they can put supers on top in Langstroth anyway, and then have the bees backfill that super with honey only, because the queen can't reach to it and can't lay eggs in it. So the brood's nest is not encroaching on the honey combs, and then they can remove an entire box by itself without having to worry where there's brood or anything. If you don't use a queen excluder, then in the Langstroth, you can have sometimes the brood nest that's spanning two boxes or sometimes even more. It's kind of hard to manage that in a way that's going to let you know where the honey is and where it starts and where the brood nest starts. It could start in the middle of a frame, right? And so that can still help you simplify your beekeeping as a backyard beekeeper, in the sense that you will know where she's at instead of having to look for her in certain cases. That can help you if you're trying to requeen a colony or find out in which box she's in, because then you're kind of like forcing her in only one box, and the one that's going to have the eggs is going to be where the queen is. So it has some functionality, but I would say that as a general rule, going through those excluders, for you're forcing all the foragers that are bringing in then, you know, potentially some of the pollen or some of the things to store into the honeycombs, you're forcing them up and down those queen excluders, which can be quite stressful. Some of them are more stressful than others, but it tends to fray their wings and just kind of be hard on their bodies as they squish through to get through. Because even though they keep the queens that are bigger out, they're also, the difference in size is not that huge, so that they actually make for a tight squeeze on the worker bees as well. And they definitely block off the drones, right?
Yes. Yeah. No matter what, the drones are screwed. They're stuck.
Yeah. So if you have a lot of drones in the box and they're stuck inside because of a queen excluder, then you might end up with a lot of dead bodies that the bees can't even carry out. Right?
What you will find is, and I have a video of this that I posted. I can't remember if it was on my apiary feed or if it was on the Hive Jive feed, but what you will find is what I call drone berries.
Drone berries, the little head.
It's literally just their head because it's the only part that the bees couldn't chew up and cannibalize. So the drones couldn't get out. There was too many of them. The bees were like, y'all got to go. You're eating us out of house and home. So they get offed. And then since how they can't drag them out the front because I have those portals on there, so there's no way for them to get out of there, they then cannibalize the abdomen and the thorax. And I have these little balls that they move to the very back of the top bar hive in the far corner in a pile. And yeah, it's all their heads
in the back.
it's a pile of heads. It is kind of bizarre. The first time that Ken ever saw one, he was like, what the heck are those? And I was like, those are drone heads. I'm laughing. It's really quite morbid, but it's true. Yes, you can use that queen excluder. Again, the commercial purpose of it is very much so I'm working on a calendar. I don't care what anything else says. My calendar says today's the day that we harvest the honey. And to be truthful about it, there are commercial operations, the bigger ones that are really advanced. It doesn't even matter if it's capped honey. It doesn't even matter how dehydrated it is because they have this massive room that will actually suck all the moisture out of everything and blow heat in there to dehydrate it down to the point where it is then quote unquote shelf stable below the 18% threshold of a moisture content. And it may not have ever even been capped. And normally the bees don't cap it until it's close to that mark anyway. But if they've got a queen excluder there, they don't have to stop. They don't have to look. They come in, they just yank the boxes off and go. But exactly. If they don't, then yes, the queen could be up in there. And if she's up in there and she's laid brood in there, well, it can throw everything off and make a mess. Because if that brood gets taken and put into that scenario and the bees aren't there to guard it, then you're going to get hive beetles. You're going to get infestations of other stuff. It could foul everything up. Or your queen could be there. And exactly. And then you just lost your queen because you yanked the stuff off. So it makes them have to stop. It makes them have to do more work and go through, be more diligent about where is everything at? What can I do? What can I not do? And they may miss out on getting an entire frame of honey because there's a small patch of brood on it. So that's kind of the reason that they do it. Now, I will say there's one other time that any beekeeper could or should use a queen excluder if you were working in a Langstroth colony, and that is if you are specifically trying to do cut comb honey or comb honey that is going to be eaten from the comb. Because in that instance, it needs to be virgin wax, meaning it is freshly drawn by the bees and no brood has ever been laid in it. If you want to do that, you got to guarantee that she hasn't ever laid in it. Now, this can happen naturally in a top bar very easily because of how far out they expand. And you will end up having your comb on the outer edge will be brand new comb, but there's already a wall of honey there that the queen just chooses not to go past. And so you can harvest those back ones and cut them out and have natural, fresh, virgin wax comb honey without worrying about it. But in a Langstroth, that's not always the case. I have seen four boxes tall where the queen is literally laid from top to bottom.
In all the boxes.
Exactly. All the boxes, exactly. And then, so you've got this issue. So if you want to do comb honey and you're going to do Ross rounds or you're going to do the little squares, the hog, I don't remember what they're called. Hog something. But anyhow, they're a little square box instead of the round box. If you're going to do that, or if you're going to do naturally drawn comb in a foundationless frame, but you want to purposely use it for that aspect, then you could use that queen excluder to try to get them to draw out the wax, fill it with just honey, and not worry about any brood being present. But that's honestly, guys, that's the only time that it would be quote unquote required. And again, if you're in a top bar, you can get that naturally. You may have a 50-50. 50% of the honeycomb may be brood comb that has now been backfilled. 50% of it may be freshly drawn wax that's never had brood in it. If you want to know, hold it up to the light. Take right. the comb out of there, take the bar out of the hive and hold it up with the sun behind it shining through it. You'll be able to tell pretty quickly if there's discolored cells inside there, it's probably had other stuff in it. But if it's all the same light pale, either from like a opaque whitish to a very, very pale yellowish color, that's perfectly fine. Yeah. So there's the why. That's where it came from.
Keeping the queen out or keeping in.
Her out or in if you're using it. So on the in aspect of it, a lot of times you will hear if you're going to go through and you're going to catch a swarm or you're going to install a package, it would behoove you to put a queen excluder on the bottom of your Langstroth between the bottom board and the actual brood box so that she can't escape. Because if she escapes and they say, you know, I've said it many times, you chose that for them. They did not choose that box. So they may try to abscond. And if they do and she can get out, they will leave. If she can't get out, they leave and they ball up and then they take roll and they say, well, shit, and they come back.
You can do that several times.
Yes, they do.
Okay, so in the Langstroth, that queen excluder is a big sheet with stripes and it just covers the entire box. That's the same size as your square box, right? And then in the external, like you said, that's more of a circular spinning disc. The big one, like you talked about, the entrance portal, but also the smaller ones that are plastic or metal. And then there's a larger version of those that's kind of in between the portals and the small couple 3-inch reducers, which is maybe 5-inch, I think it is, or 4-inch discs as well. Those are metal. And so those are your options. You can also do the disc entrance reducers on a Langstroth that has a no opening, no horizontal opening, but has a round entrance that you drill. And actually, that's my preferred way to do this. I cannot stand messing with those queen with those entrance reducers. They always slip out of place or are hard to put in. And it's just kind of, I like the convenience of the discs because you can also, you're ready to transport a hive if you need to. You just close it.
Yeah, if you got to seal it up, turn it to vent and you're good to go.
So to your point, keeping those queens in for packages or swarms that you're trying to install and where they might not otherwise want to stay is great. But you have to remember that in it's happened many times where they will do that a couple of times. And then when they're really meaning to leave and the queen is stuck inside, they might yank her through and shred her to pieces. So that happens as well, where they'll force make her get out and yep. kill her that way. So
yeah, the other alternative to that too is that it's not guaranteed. So in that scenario, you lost your queen because they killed her trying to pull her through the thing. In other scenarios, if she is undernourished and not laying, she gets skinnier and skinnier and skinnier. The only thing then that she's got to fit through there is her thorax itself. And so sometimes you can have instances where new virgin queens can leave and go mate and come back, or you can have your queen actually escape if they've really intent on swarming and they've thinned her down enough. There's some times that she can make it through it, but that kind of depends on the material. It depends on the type of queen excluder. They come in plastic, metal, wood. Some of them can bow and bend, and you know, some of them warp.
Some of them are sharper.
Some of them are sharper, which would cause more tearing and wear on the body of the bee. So those are the potential downfalls of it's not always guaranteed, right? If she really wants out of that hive, she could potentially get out. It may not be alive, but. Right.
So the other aspect of things is that those need to be handled or used very carefully. They're not for permanent use, first of all. I see a lot of beekeepers tend to set them up and then leave them there the entire time throughout the season. So there's several issues with that. One of the main issues, you kind of touched upon it, is if you have a scenario where you have a colony that's swarmed, and you've got that queen excluder where they're building the queen cells, then she might or might not be able to get out and get mated, right? So it's at the entrance, at the bottom ground, if she can get out, she might not be able to come back through.
That's true too.
And then the other really dangerous thing to do is to leave it throughout the winter where your brood nest might travel up, especially in a Langstroth, to the honey as it runs out of resources and is traveling up to eat through the honey. and she won't be able to get through. She'll be left behind without the heat of the cluster, and she'll freeze to death. You'll lose your queen that way. So that those are like really meant for very temporary.
During the nectar flow.
You have to be very careful with those because you can have a lot of unintended consequences that are very mechanically problematic.
And completely preventable. So the one that you said, that last one about winter, that is probably the number one mistake that I've seen people make with queen excluders is they put it on, they did their main honey flow, everything came in, and then they went and they did their honey harvest and they left one medium on there, but they left that queen excluder. So they got a deep, a queen excluder, and a medium. All the food is up in the medium. And then winter came and they never went and actually truly winterized the boxes and took the queen excluder off. So suddenly, like you said, they've eaten all of the food in that deep box over the first month or two of winter and they start moving up. Well, all the workers go up, but the queen can't. And suddenly she's not there where she can be fed. She's not there where she can stay warm. She's not in the cluster where the heat's generated. And you literally have just killed your colony because the queen dies. There are no eggs because it's the middle of winter, so they can't make an emergency queen. And
there wouldn't be any drones to make with anyway.
That's right. And then by the time it's all said and done, if you have a colony left by the time spring comes, it's probably going to end up being a laying worker colony. So it's not a good scenario.
No, and then one good use of it, if you have a colony that you're trying to requeen and you can't find a queen anywhere. And that allows you, like, let's say you have a hyper defensive colony and you don't want to be looking for that queen throughout, you know, those boxes. You can potentially put that queen excluders between one each, between each of the boxes, actually, depending on how many you have. And the one that you come back a week later, the one that has eggs or young larvae will be the one where the queen is. So you've isolated that queen in that box, and that makes it easier to find her.
Yep.
But another version, you don't even need to do that. Another version would be to split that colony box by box with their own bottom board and their own lids. And then you come back in a week and you know which one has the queen same way. So you don't even need that queen excluder to be identifying that one. And then when you find her, you can requeen and then you can recombine. So it could be a useful aspect of the queen excluder, but you don't even need to do that. My big thing is that we try to minimize the amount of equipment that we use. We don't want to have pieces that we don't use all the time, having to store them, having to remember them, having to just, you know, clean them up, all this stuff. And so we don't use queen excluders. The other reason we don't is because, so we do have Langstroth, but we don't use them with a Langstroth. We prefer the colony to build to whatever configuration is best for their health. Honey frames are going to be on the outside. They're going to tend to be on the up above as well. And if we don't have to harvest an entire box because we don't have to do the way the commercial beekeepers do. If we harvest any honey, we could just pick out whatever we need that we know is truly surplus instead of having to do it as a chain, you know, just complete industrial version of things. We have the time to look for the honey frames that we need to pull out. But in a tabar, in a horizontal in general, where you have that brood's nest that's staying by the entrance and the rest, like you were talking about, you never need a queen excluder. You really don't. The honey barrier is going to do that for you. Now, we're doing these conversions of Langstroth to tabar. You can do that with the easy nukes, or you can do that with the full-blown colonies that you tie to your the end piece of your tabar hive. And then if sometimes they're kind of keep building brood on both sides and you really are wanting to move them along to really commit to the tabar, to the horizontal configuration, then you can slip a queen excluder, make sure that your queen is on the tabar side of things. And then eventually the brood on the Langstroth side will emerge and they will backfill that with honey. So you can do the same thing you would do vertically, but now you've committed your colony to tabar, meaning that conversion happens faster towards the end of the season, like near the fall, when we're looking at the winter coming and we're like, well, we really would like to complete that conversion. That's when we might use, we've used a few, but other than that, we never, ever, ever use queen excluders.
So,
except at the entrance, like you said. So
yes, that's what I was going to say. So you mentioned a couple of things. You were talking about slipping one in between there. So the beauty of a plastic queen excluder is that you can cut it. Yeah.
Yes.
And so we were talking before the episode started about how I have chopped them suckers up and used them for all kinds of things that they were not intended for. I've even used them on pollen feeders when I didn't want other things to get into the pollen feeder. I have cut a little square of the queen excluder, put it over the end of the pollen feeder, and then it actually keeps some of the wasps out and it keeps birds and mice out of there. But the workers can still go in, roll around in the pollen, get what they need and come back out. So I've used them for that, but you can cut them to fit the shape of a top bar. Or, you know, if you've got a nuke, you could cut one in half and you could stick it over the top of that. Like, there's different things that you can actually use those queen excluders for.
If it's plastic.
If it's plastic. And that's the key. Depending on the material you got. If you got the metal one, you're not probably wanting to be cutting that up. That's not going to work. If you got the wood one, it's probably going to break and splinter in places you didn't want it to. But the plastic one is very versatile to use for other things. Now, when you were talking about using it or not using it in a Langstroth type colony, there's a couple of key points with that too. One, so, well, actually, let's start at the beginning. This is a scenario that I like to talk about a lot when we do presentations to beekeepers and clubs and stuff. But if you have two colonies that are identical, they've got the same amount of bees and everything else, to start with.
I'm laughing at identical.
That, well, right. I mean, in air quotes, okay? It's just for the purpose of the example. To start with, they're both identical. Let's say that they both got 20 to 30,000 bees. They both have their queen. They're just a single deep box, and you're going to add boxes on top. One of them, you're going to put a queen excluder. One of them, you're not. In this hypothetical scenario, we're going to assume that it takes 20,000 bees to do everything that needs to be done inside the colony, and anybody above that is going to be your workforce, your forage force that's going to go out and bring stuff in. If you put the queen excluder on the colony on the left, she is confined to the deep box. And if she's laying prolifically and she lays all 10 frames, solid brood, as soon as they're full, she cannot do anything else until they go through that 21-day cycle, pupate, and emerge as adults and open those cells back up.
That's true.
Her growth period, the colony's growth period, is going to be limited by that because now the queen has to wait. On the other side, you've got a colony that does not have a queen excluder. So she lays in that entire deep box as well and does the same thing that the one on the left did. But when she fills up that deep, she moves up to the next box and she fills it up.
The population is going to grow exponentially.
And then exactly. And she moves up to the next box and she fills it up. Now, that's awesome because you've got this colony over here that went from 20,000 to 40,000, but this colony went from 20,000 to 60,000.
Right.
Well, who has the most foragers? The one with 60,000 bees. They're going to be able to bring you in more honey.
Exactly.
So
that's the paradox here. You're going to end up with possibly much more honey in the unrestricted colony than you would in the restricted one. The other aspect of things is that you might lead them to congestion and swarming behavior.
That is exactly the point I was going to make. Yes. That was my next point, was now the one on the left, if she ran out of room and you're not lucky, well, we've got lots of food. We got lots of bees. I have nowhere else to lay. Guess it means it's time to swarm. And here come the swarm cells. So yes, that was the next point. Exactly. Now, the other thing on it is, okay, well, now I've got this tower over here that has all of this brood in it. And I've got this one on the left that just has empty comb that they're able to put honey in. What happens over there with all the brood? Well, as that brood emerges, they start backfilling, and they will backfill from the top of the comb down, which means they're going to start in your top box and they're going to backfill down. And as they do, it constricts the brood nest back down closer to that first box, and everything above it continues to get backfilled, which, if you are a patient beekeeper and you are following the cues of your bees, is not a problem. Because if you go out there and you check and you pull out a frame and it's all capped, but in the middle of it, there's a patch of brood still. If you put it back and you come back a couple of weeks later, the brood will have emerged. They will have filled it with nectar. And hopefully by then, even that nectar may be dehydrated enough that they've started capping it or it's already capped. Now it's a full frame of honey. Take it and extract it. It just means you might have to wait a few extra weeks. And this is something that I have said many times on the podcast, once even pissed some people off because they took it extremely personally. But I'm going to say it again because it bears repeating. You do not have to go by a beekeeper calendar. Just because hypothetically you should always do your harvest on this date doesn't mean the bees are always ready for that. And those individuals were in the same area that I was in. they harvested on the beginning of July. I did my harvest half the time in the middle of August.
Right. When you know they've got enough. When
yes.
Yeah.
And so it's really following the cue of the bees and not trying to stick to a strict regimen or regime of it has to be this way, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. First of all beekeeping is hyper local. From one neighborhood to the other one, 5 miles down the road, you might not have the same, you know, configuration and harvest. But on top of that, those calendars are made for commercial beekeepers that
That's
are
right.
not respecting the seasons of beekeeping, because they have to take their bees to almonds and pollination contracts out of season. So they're brooding them up out of season. They're doing everything out of season, feeding them and giving them pollen supplements, substitutes for that very reason. Therefore, they are completely free to follow whatever calendar they want. And they're doing it as such a large scale, they've got to be able to plan for it. So they don't follow the beekeeping cycles, the natural cycles anyway. They're kind of doing their thing on the calendar of their own. But we're backyard beekeepers. We're not doing any of this. And it behooves us, in my opinion, to follow the natural cycles that are happening in your local area. And it varies. For various locations, it's going to be slightly different.
Well, it varies for the same location from year to year, too.
And from colony to colony, to be honest with you.
That's true. Right? So Mother Nature doesn't even follow that calendar. There, you could have one year where it is super wet all year long. You can have another year where your dearth starts a month earlier than it should.
El Nino, right there. Your calendar is moot half of the time, right?
Right. So
it's not going to follow those same patterns of weather and forage.
Right. So there may be a year that, yes, somewhere around the beginning of July, they may have already stopped bringing in nectar. The dearth has already started and they've already capped everything because it's been very humid or very dry and not as humid. And so that year, sure, you can do your harvest then. But then there's other years where it's super humid out there and it's super wet. And even though they've got it capped, it's still above 19% moisture content in it. And it takes them a while to slowly pull that back down and get that all done. So maybe that year you don't actually harvest until the middle of August. You know, it's like, it's following the bees is all you got to do is follow the bees' cue.
And I'm going to get myself in trouble when I say, basically, beekeepers like to a good recipe. They like to not have to think about it. They like to just be given the answers. Yeah, John is like cringing big time back there. It's okay. I'm throwing myself under the bus. I know that. But it's not necessarily what's going to work best for your beekeeping operation. Being in tune, reading your colonies, knowing what's coming in and just observing is going to do you a whole lot better. And it does take more work.
It does
take more deductions. It does take more thinking about this. But in the end, your bees and yourself will be better off.
Yeah. If you're one of those individuals who needs to be told what to do and when to do it, that's fine, but you need to learn who to listen to. And you shouldn't be listening to a book, or you shouldn't be listening to another beekeeper who's in a different area. You need to be listening to your bees, because those are the ones who are going to tell you and always be correct as to when it is time to do what. So you have to be in tune with the colony. Right. And as long as you are, nothing else matters.
And it's the same thing with feeding, emergency feeding. We don't feed, you know, we might if it's an emergency and they really clearly need it, but not prophylactically. So when people ask, should I be feeding, you know, should I be doing this? Should I be putting a queen excluder in? Should I do any of this stuff right now? I don't know. What do you have in your box? What's going on outside in the environment? What are you looking at in terms of forage? What's the size of your population? What's the health of your colony? There's so many parameters. You can't really give an answer. There's no recipe that's going to work out.
If I had known that you were going to specifically say a certain phrase of that in advance, I could have went back and gotten any number of clips of Ken and I talking where he says exactly that. And my response is always, I don't know, Ken, did you look inside the hive? What's going on in the comb?
What's going on in the hive and what's coming outside, right?
Oh,
But yeah, no, I do like the queen excluder on the entrance, the disc entrance reducers. I like that there because it allows me to actually, I don't use it for the queen excluder. I use it for closing it for transport if I need to. And then with the aeration. And then I really like having, especially for the top bar, little baby top bar nukes boxes. And then I can store the comb in there and close it so the bees can't rob it, right? Yeah. Or if I've frozen my comb before and I know it's free of wax moths and small hive beetle larvae, then I can thaw it out and make sure it's not humid anymore. Just put it in those boxes and close it. And then it's protected. You don't have to keep it in your freezer.
That's a very good point. You have to make sure that your bars are cut good and that they are bug tight, not airtight, but bug tight up there at the top. Yeah. And that will help keep things from wiggling down inside there. Yeah. But the excluders on the front, those discs, those entrance portals that I like so much, I love them because I will put them on there. And if I am purposefully trying to raise a queen or I know that they're raising a queen and she's going to need to go mate, I will actually spin that around to where it's on partial vent and partial open so that it's just big enough the queen's fat booty can get in and out. And right. I know that it's good to go. Then I can turn it back on queen exclude once I know everything's good. I can do a 50-50 queen exclude, drone exclude, where it gives you a little bit smaller on one side and a little bit bigger on the other. And honestly, I'm using it more as an obstacle than anything, because if robbing does start to take place, you can spin it around to where you've got partial vent and partial queen exclude, and it narrows the amount of space that bees can get in and out. It's the same thing as trying to put in your entrance reducer or put on a the robbing guard and keep the robbers out from doing things like that. Well, you can prevent robbing by using those discs and having them on different settings. So
that's an excellent point. But by the way, this is exactly why that hindrance to the traffic going in and out, you don't want that to last, because it's going to negatively impact the functioning of your colony and its efficiencies in gathering food and resources for the colony. So, and even the orientation flights for the young bees, all this stuff is going to be negatively impacted. So you have to be really conscious of the impact that it has long term.
Yeah. The whole goal is to change it as needed. Right. And not to do what I did, if you remember the horror story from many, many, many years ago when I had, I don't even remember at this point how many nukes it was. I want to say it was like 10 nukes in a line that I had loaded up, and I closed them by turning the disc to vent, and I took them out to the staging area so that the people could come and pick them up. And I left them on vent because when I got to the staging area and I set them down, I saw a swarm over in the tree and I was like, oh, crap. And I went and I caught the swarm and I was distracted. And then I put it in the truck and I drove away and I left these 10 nukes sitting there on vent, and they all overheated and died because nobody could get out. They couldn't relieve the congestion inside the colony. You know, so it is not meant to be left and stay for sure. It is something that you have to constantly monitor. So from that regard, it is a very physical hands-on aspect. It is not a set it and walk away and never go back, because that's the same scenario as having your queen excluder in there and not taking it off for winter. It can cause problems. So
yeah. I do like the, you know, so what I do for the robbing is that actually in the fall and in the early spring, when that the robbing is increased, and the population is at its lowest, I tend to decrease it, the actual full entrance, but I have round entrances. So I spin it so that it looks like a half a moon or something like that, right? And it's just enough for a pinky for like one bee or two bee at a time.
Yep.
And it's not until I see a lot more traffic that I'm going to go and open it up, because that's really going to help them guard their entrance a lot better. So that's not a queen excluder functionality, but it's kind of a reduction of the entrance and the increases the defensibility of the colony.
Yeah. And one of the things that has kind of gone on, said we've gone on for quite a while on this entrance portal disc and not necessarily the queen excluder itself, but the behind the scenes of that. And I think yours is very much like mine. The hole that is behind this disc can be anywhere from 1 to 2 inches in diameter. Yeah. It can be a large hole so that it can actually take up the full advantage of the disc. But the cool thing about the disc is, like you said, you can turn it to where only a tiny little sliver of that hole is actually open and available. So you can fully control, I want one or two bees to go through at a time, or I'm going to give them a bigger section, but it's going to have the bars across it from the queen excluder, or I'm going to move them. So I'm going to put it on vent, or it's booming outside and I'm just going to open that sucker wide open and let them go. Yeah. You know, like it gives you options.
It does give you options. So you can do it with a single larger hole, or we do it with 3/4 holes in a line. Basically, we plug up the ones we're not using, and we still have that discant reducer and that little the last one where we can do the things we just mentioned. But you can also have it straddle a couple of, if you have a bigger disc, you can have it straddle a couple of the, three of these little holes. So it gives you a lot of modularity, basically.
It does. So there you go. If you felt like this conversation has excluded you, maybe you shouldn't be using excluders.
Right. Don't feel excluded.
Don't feel excluded. That's what I'll title it as. I'm going to title it as "To Be Excluded."
We are inclusive.
We're trying to be inclusive. So stop using your excluders. No, it's okay. If it is something that fits your purpose and your beekeeping practice and style, then use it, but use it responsibly and use it within the context of what it is you're trying to do.
Knowingly
and purposefully, and then take it off when that time has passed and you're no longer needing it for those purposes. Those are the key takeaways there. But if you're happy with having the one deep in a queen excluder, or if you're happy of having the whole colony open to let her do whatever she wants, go for it. That's up to you. And ultimately, if it works for you and you're successful, that's all that matters.
But having the knowledge of the potential implications is important, right? You need to know what the trade-off is with your situation so that you know the pros and cons and what you're leaving on the table when you use them and what you're leaving on the table when you're not using them.
That's right. The more you know. We need that little doo-doo-doo thing flies across the screen.
Exactly. It was started playing in my head.
There you go, everybody. Hopefully you have learned a little bit and had a few laughs along on this episode. And as I said earlier, next week we will be talking about some hypothetical scenarios and implications of new research on how bees learn and how that could potentially impact how we keep bees. So stay tuned for that. But until then, as always, everyone, be good.
And be mindful. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
This Hive Jive production was made possible by amazing patrons like you, and we appreciate your support. To all our Hive Jive junkies out there, you truly are the bee's knees.
Where's the stop button?